The Surrender at Munich, September 29th to 30th, 1938. In this Baroque Bavarian city, where in the murky back rooms of run-down little cafes he had made his lowly start as a politician, and in whose streets he had suffered the fiasco of the beer hall putsch, Adolf Hitler greeted like a conqueror the heads of governments of Great Britain, France, and Italy at 12:30 on September 29th. Very early that morning he had gone to Kufstein on the former Austro-German frontier to meet Mussolini and set up a basis for common action at the conference. In the train coming up to Munich, Hitler was in a bellicose mood, explaining to the Duce over maps how he intended to liquidate Czechoslovakia. Either the talks beginning that day must be immediately successful, he said, or he would resort to arms. Besides, Chano, who was present, quotes the Führer as adding, "The time will come when we shall have to fight side by side against France and England." Mussolini agreed. Chamberlain made no similar effort to see Daladier beforehand to work out a joint strategy for the two Western democracies with which to confront the two fascist dictators. Indeed, it became evident to many of us in contact with the British and French delegations in Munich as the day progressed that Chamberlain had come to Munich absolutely determined that no one, certainly not the Czechs and not even the French, should stand in the way of his reaching a quick agreement with Hitler. At 6:45 the evening before, Chamberlain had sent a message to President Beneš informing him officially of the meeting at Munich. "I shall have the interests of Czechoslovakia," he stated, "fully in mind. I go there, to Munich, with the intention of trying to find accommodation between the positions of the German and Czechoslovak governments." Beneš had immediately replied, "I beg that nothing may be done at Munich without Czechoslovakia being heard." In the case of Daladier, who went around all day as if in a daze, no precaution was necessary, but the determined Prime Minister took no risks. The talks, which began at 12:45 p.m. in the so-called Führerhaus in the Königsplatz, were anticlimactic and constituted little more than a mere formality of rendering to Hitler exactly what he wanted when he wanted it. Dr. Schmidt, the indomitable interpreter, who was called upon to function in three languages, German, French, and English, noticed from the beginning an atmosphere of general goodwill. Ambassador Henderson later remembered that at no stage of the conversations did they become heated. No one presided. The proceedings unfolded informally, and judging by the German minutes of the meeting which came to light after the war, the British Prime Minister and the French Premier fairly fell over themselves to agree with Hitler, even when he made the following opening statement. He had now declared in his speech at the Sportpalast that he would in any case march in on October 1st. He had received the answer that this action would have the character of an act of violence. Hence the task arose to absolve this action from such a character. Action must, however, be taken at once. The conferees got down to business when Mussolini, speaking third in turn, Daladier was left to the last, said that in order to bring about a practical solution of the problem, he had brought with him a definite written proposal. Its origins are interesting and remained unknown to Chamberlain, I believe, to his death. From the memoirs of François Poncet and Henderson, it is obvious that they too were ignorant of them. In fact, the story only became known long after the violent deaths of the two dictators. What the Duce now fobbed off as his own compromise plan had been hastily drafted the day before in the German Foreign Office in Berlin by Göring, Neurath, and Weizsäcker, behind the back of Foreign Minister von Ribbentrop, whose judgment the three men did not trust. Göring took it to Hitler, who said it might do, and then it was hurriedly translated into French by Dr. Schmidt and passed along to the Italian ambassador, Attolico, who telephoned the text of it to the Italian dictator in Rome just before he entrained for Munich. Thus it was that the Italian proposals, which provided the informal conference not only with its sole agenda, but with the basic terms which eventually became the Munich Agreement, were in fact German proposals concocted in Berlin. Erich Kort recounted the German origins of Mussolini's proposals in his testimony before U.S. Military Tribunal 4, at Nuremberg on June 4, 1948, in the case of USA versus Ernst Weizsäcker. Documents on German Foreign Policy, Volume 2, page 1005, gives a summary from the official trial transcript. Court also tells the story in his book, Wahn und Wirklichkeit, pages 129 to 131. Dr. Schmidt, Hitler's interpreter, page 111, substantiates Court's account and remarks that translating the Duce's proposals was easy because he had already translated them the day before in Berlin. Ciano, the Italian foreign minister, in a diary entry of September 29th to 30th from Munich, tells of Mussolini producing his document, which in fact had been telephoned to us by our embassy the previous evening, as expressing the desires of the German government. Ciano's Hidden Diary, 1937 to 38, page 167. This must have seemed fairly obvious from the text, which closely followed Hitler's rejected Godesberg demands. But it was not obvious to Daladier and Chamberlain or to their ambassadors in Berlin, who now attended them. The Premier, according to the German minutes, welcomed the Duce's proposal, which had been made in an objective and realistic spirit, and the Prime Minister also welcomed the Duce's proposal and declared that he himself had conceived of a solution on the lines of this proposal. As for Ambassador Henderson, as he later wrote, he thought Mussolini had tactfully put forward as his own a combination of Hitler's and the Anglo-French proposals, while Ambassador François Poncet got the impression that the conferees were working on a British memorandum drawn up by Horace Wilson. So easily were the British and French statesmen and diplomats, bent on appeasement at any cost, deceived. With the Italian proposals so warmly welcomed by all present, there remained but a few details to iron out. Chamberlain, as perhaps might have been expected from an ex-businessman and former chancellor of the Exchequer, wanted to know who would compensate the Czech government for the public property which would pass to Germany in the Sudetenland. Hitler, who, according to François Poncet, appeared somewhat pale and worried, and annoyed because he could not follow, as Mussolini could, the talk in French and English, replied heatedly there would be no compensation. When the Prime Minister objected to the stipulation that the Czechs moving out of the Sudetenland could not even take their cattle, this had been one of the Godesberg demands, exclaiming, "Does this mean that the farmers will be expelled but that their cattle will be retained?" Hitler exploded. "Our time is too valuable to be wasted on such trivialities," he shouted at Chamberlain. The Prime Minister dropped the matter. He did insist at first that a Czech representative ought to be present, or at least, as he put it, be available. His country, he said, could naturally undertake no guarantee that the Sudeten territory would be evacuated by October 10th, as Mussolini had proposed, if no assurance of this was forthcoming from the Czech government. Daladier gave him lukewarm support. The French government, he said, would in no wise tolerate procrastination in this matter by the Czech government. But he thought the presence of a Czech representative who could be consulted if necessary would be an advantage. But Hitler was adamant. He would permit no Czechs in his presence. Daladier meekly gave in, but Chamberlain finally won a small concession. It was agreed that a Czech representative might make himself available in the next room, as the Prime Minister proposed. And indeed, during the afternoon session, two Czech representatives, Dr. Wojciech Mastny, the Czech minister in Berlin, and Dr. Hubert Masaryk from the Prague Foreign Office, did arrive and were coolly ushered into an adjoining room. There, after they had been left from 2 p.m. to 7 to cool their heels, the roof figuratively fell in on them. At the latter hour, Frank Ashton Gwatkin, who had been a member of the Runciman mission and was now on Chamberlain's staff, came to break the bad news to them. A general agreement had been reached, the details of which he could not yet give to them, but it was much harsher than the Franco-British proposals. When Masaryk asked if the Czechs couldn't be heard, the Englishman answered, as the Czech representative later reported to his government, that I seemed to ignore how difficult was the situation of the great powers, and that I could not understand how hard it had been to negotiate with Hitler. At 10 p.m., the two unhappy Czechs were taken to Sir Horace Wilson, the Prime Minister's faithful adviser. On behalf of Chamberlain, Wilson informed them of the main points in the four-power agreement and handed them a map of the Sudeten areas which were to be evacuated by the Czechs at once. When the two envoys attempted to protest, the British official cut them short. He had nothing more to say, he stated, and promptly left the room. The Czechs continued to protest to Ashton Gwatkin, who had remained with them, but to no avail. If you do not accept, he admonished them as he prepared to go, you will have to settle your affairs with the Germans absolutely alone. Perhaps the French may tell you this more gently, but you can believe me that they share our views. They are disinterested. This was the truth, wretched though it must have sounded to the two Czech emissaries. Shortly after 1 a.m. on September 30th, Hitler, Chamberlain, Mussolini, and Daladier, in that order, affixed their signatures to the Munich Agreement providing for the German army to begin its march into Czechoslovakia on October 1st, as the Führer had always said it would, and to complete the occupation of the Sudetenland by October 10th. Hitler had got what had been refused him at Gottesberg. The agreement was dated September 29th, though not actually signed until the early morning hours of September 30th. It stipulated that the German occupation of the predominantly German territory should be carried out by German troops in four stages, from October 1st through October 7th. The remaining territory, after being delimited by the International Commission, would be occupied by October 10th. The commission was to consist of representatives of the four big powers and Czechoslovakia. Britain, France, and Italy agreed that the evacuation of the territory shall be completed by October 10th, without any existing installations having been destroyed, and that the Czechoslovak government will be held responsible for carrying out the evacuation without damage to the said installations. Further, the International Commission would arrange for plebiscites, not later than the end of November, in the regions where the ethnographical character was in doubt, and would make the final determination of the new frontiers. In an annex to the accord, Britain and France declared that they stand by their offer relating to an international guarantee of the new boundaries of the Czechoslovak state against unprovoked aggression. When the question of the Polish and Hungarian minorities has been settled, Germany and Italy, for their part, will give a guarantee to Czechoslovakia. The pledge of plebiscites was never carried out. Neither Germany nor Italy ever gave the guarantee to Czechoslovakia against aggression, even after the matter of the Polish and Hungarian minorities was settled, and, as we shall see, Britain and France declined to honor their guarantee. There remained the painful matter, painful at least to the victims, of informing the Czechs of what they had to give up and how soon. Hitler and Mussolini were not interested in this part of the ceremony and withdrew, leaving the task to the representatives of Czechoslovakia's ally, France, and of Great Britain. The scene was vividly described by Masaryk in his official report to the Czech Foreign Office. At 1:30 a.m. we were taken into the hall where the conference had been held. There were present Mr. Chamberlain, Monsieur Daladier, Sir Horace Wilson, Monsieur Leger, Secretary General of the French Foreign Office, Mr. Ashton Gwatkin, Dr. Mastny, and myself. The atmosphere was oppressive. Sentence was about to be passed. The French, obviously nervous, seemed anxious to preserve French prestige before the court. Mr. Chamberlain, in a long introductory speech, referred to the agreement and gave the text to Dr. Mastny. The Czechs began to ask several questions, but Mr. Chamberlain was yawning continuously without making any effort to conceal his yawns. I asked Messieurs Daladier and Leger whether they expected a declaration or answer of our government to the agreement. Monsieur Daladier was noticeably nervous. Monsieur Leger replied that the four statesmen had not much time. He added hurriedly and with superficial casualness that no answer was required from us, that they regarded the plan as accepted, that our government had that very day, at the latest at 3 p.m., to send its representative to Berlin to the sitting of the commission, and finally that the Czechoslovak officer who was to be sent would have to be in Berlin on Saturday, in order to fix the details for the evacuation of the first zone. The atmosphere, he said, was beginning to become dangerous for the whole world. He spoke to us harshly enough. This was a Frenchman. Mr. Chamberlain did not conceal his weariness. They gave us a second slightly corrected map. Then they finished with us and we could go. I remember from that fateful night the light of victory in Hitler's eyes as he strutted down the broad steps of the Führerhaus after the meeting. the cockiness of Mussolini, laced in his special militia uniform, the yawns of Chamberlain and his air of pleasant sleepiness as he returned to the Regina Palace Hotel. Daladier, I wrote in my diary that night, on the other hand, looked a completely beaten and broken man. He came over to the Regina to say goodbye to Chamberlain. Someone asked, or started to ask, "Monsieur le Président, are you satisfied with the agreement?" He turned as if to say something, but he was too tired and defeated, and the words did not come out, and he stumbled out the door in silence. Chamberlain was not through conferring with Hitler about the peace of the world. Early the next morning, September 30th, refreshed by a few hours of sleep and pleased with his labors of the previous day, he sought out the Führer at his private apartment in Munich to discuss further the state of Europe, and to secure a small concession which he apparently thought would improve his political position at home. According to Dr. Schmidt, who acted as interpreter, and who was the sole witness of this unexpected meeting, Hitler was pale and moody. He listened absent-mindedly as the exuberant head of the British government expressed his confidence that Germany would adopt a generous attitude in the implementation of the Munich Agreement, and renewed his hope that the Czechs would not be so unreasonable as to make difficulties, and that if they did make them, Hitler would not bomb Prague with the dreadful losses among the civilian population which it would entail. This was only the beginning of a long and rambling discourse which would seem incredible coming from a British prime minister, even one who had made so abject a surrender to the German dictator the night before, had it not been recorded by Dr. Schmidt in an official Foreign Office memorandum. Even today, when one reads this captured document, it seems difficult to believe. But the British leader's opening remarks were only the prelude to what was to come. After what must have seemed to the morose German dictator an interminable exposition by Chamberlain in proposing further cooperation in bringing an end to the Spanish Civil War, which German and Italian volunteers were winning for Franco, in furthering disarmament, world economic prosperity, political peace in Europe, and even a solution of the Russian problem, the Prime Minister drew out of his pocket a sheet of paper on which he had written something which he hoped they would both sign and release for immediate publication. "We, the German Führer and Chancellor, and the British Prime Minister," it read, "have had a further meeting today and are agreed in recognizing that the question of Anglo-German relations is of the first importance for the two countries and for Europe. We regard the agreement signed last night and the Anglo-German naval agreement as symbolic of the desire of our two peoples never to go to war with one another again. We are resolved that the method of consultation shall be the method adopted to deal with any other questions that may concern our two countries, and we are determined to continue our efforts to remove possible sources of difference, and thus to contribute to assure the peace of Europe." Hitler read the declaration and quickly signed it, much to Chamberlain's satisfaction, as Dr. Schmidt noted in his official report. The interpreter's impression was that the Führer agreed to it with a certain reluctance, only to please Chamberlain, who, he recounts further, thanked the Führer warmly and underlined the great psychological effect which he expected from this document. The deluded British Prime Minister did not know, of course, that, as the secret German and Italian documents would reveal much later, Hitler and Mussolini had already agreed at this very meeting in Munich that in time they would have to fight side by side against Great Britain. Nor, as we shall shortly see, did he divine much else that already was fermenting in Hitler's lugubrious mind. Chamberlain returned to London, as did Daladier to Paris, in triumph. Brandishing the declaration which he had signed with Hitler, the jubilant Prime Minister faced a large crowd that pressed into Downing Street. After listening to shouts of "Good old Neville!" and a lusty singing of "For he's a jolly good fellow," Chamberlain smilingly spoke a few words from a second-story window in number 10. "My good friends," he said, "this is the second time in our history that there has come back from Germany to Downing Street peace with honor. I believe it is peace in our time." The reference is to Disraeli's return from the Congress of Berlin in 1878. The Times declared that "no conqueror returning from a victory on the battlefield has come adorned with nobler laurels." There was a spontaneous movement to raise a national fund of thanksgiving in Chamberlain's honor, which he graciously turned down. Only Duff Cooper, the First Lord of the Admiralty, resigned from the cabinet, and when in the ensuing Commons debate Winston Churchill, still a voice in the wilderness, began to utter his memorable words, "We have sustained a total, unmitigated defeat," he was forced to pause, as he later recorded, until the storm of protest against such a remark had subsided. The mood in Prague was naturally quite different. At 6:20 a.m. on September 30th, the German chargé d'affaires had routed the Czech foreign minister, Dr. Krofta, out of bed and handed him the text of the Munich Agreement, together with a request that Czechoslovakia send two representatives to the first meeting of the International Commission, which was to supervise the execution of the accord, at 5 p.m. in Berlin. For President Benesch, who conferred all morning at the Hradschin Palace with the political and military leaders, there was no alternative but to submit. Britain and France had not only deserted his country, but would now back Hitler in the use of armed force, should he turn down the terms of Munich. At 10 minutes to 1, Czechoslovakia surrendered, under protest to the world, as the official statement put it. "We were abandoned. We stand alone," General Sirovi, the new premier, explained bitterly in a broadcast to the Czechoslovak people at 5 p.m. To the very last, Britain and France maintained their pressure on the country they had seduced and betrayed. During the day, the British, French, and Italian ministers went to see Dr. Krofta to make sure that there was no last-minute revolt of the Czechs against the surrender. The German chargé, Dr. Henke, in a dispatch to Berlin, described the scene. The French minister's attempt to address words of condolence to Krofta was cut short by the foreign minister's remark. "We have been forced into this situation. Now everything is at an end. Today it is our turn. Tomorrow it will be the turn of others." The British minister succeeded with difficulty in saying that Chamberlain had done his utmost. He received the same answer as the French minister. The foreign minister was a completely broken man and intimated only one wish, that the three ministers should quickly leave the room. President Benesch resigned on October 5th on the insistence of Berlin, and when it became evident that his life was in danger, flew to England and exile. He was replaced provisionally by General Sirovi. On November 30th, Dr. Emil Hacha, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, a well-intentioned but weak and senile man of 66, was selected by the National Assembly to be president of what remained of Czechoslovakia, which was now officially spelled with a hyphen. What Chamberlain and Daladier at Munich had neglected to give Germany and Czechoslovakia, the so-called International Commission proceeded to hand over. This hastily formed body consisted of the Italian, British, and French ambassadors and the Czech minister in Berlin, and Baron von Weizsäcker, the state secretary in the German Foreign Office. Every dispute over additional territory for the Germans was settled in their favor, more than once under the threat from Hitler and OKW to resort to armed force. Finally, on October 13th, the Commission voted to dispense with the plebiscites which the Munich Agreement had called for in the disputed regions. There was no need for them. The Poles and the Hungarians, after threatening military action against the helpless nation, now swept down like vultures to get a slice of Czechoslovak territory. Poland, at the insistence of Foreign Minister Josef Beck, who for the next 12 months will be a leading character in this narrative, took some 650 square miles of territory around Teschen, comprising a population of 228,000 inhabitants, of whom 133,000 were Czechs. Hungary got a larger slice in the award meted out on November 2nd by Ribbentrop and Chano, 7,500 square miles, with a population of 500,000 Magyars and 272,000 Slovaks. Moreover, the truncated and now defenseless country was forced by Berlin to install a pro-German government of obvious fascist tendencies. It was clear that from now on the Czechoslovak nation existed at the mercy of the leader of the Third Reich. The consequences of Munich. Under the terms of the Munich Agreement, Hitler got substantially what he had demanded at Godesberg, and the International Commission, bowing to his threats, gave him considerably more. The final settlement of November 20, 1938, forced Czechoslovakia to cede to Germany 11,000 square miles of territory, in which dwelt 2,800,000 Sudeten Germans and 800,000 Czechs. Within this area lay all the vast Czech fortifications which hitherto had formed the most formidable defensive line in Europe, with the possible exception of the Maginot Line in France. But that was not all. Czechoslovakia's entire system of rail, road, telephone, and telegraph communications was disrupted. According to German figures, the dismembered country lost 66% of its coal, 80% of its lignite, 86% of its chemicals, 80% of its cement, 80% of its textiles, 70% of its iron and steel, 70% of its electric power, and 40% of its timber. A prosperous industrial nation was split up and bankrupted overnight. No wonder that Jodl could write joyfully in his diary on the night of Munich, "The Pact of Munich is signed. Czechoslovakia as a power is out. The genius of the Führer and his determination not to shun even a world war have again won the victory without the use of force. The hope remains that the incredulous, the weak, and the doubtful people have been converted and will remain that way." Many of the doubtful were converted, and the few who were not were plunged into despair. The generals, such as Beck, Halder, and Witzleben, and their civilian advisers, had again been proved wrong. Hitler had got what he wanted, had achieved another great conquest without firing a shot. His prestige soared to new heights. No one who was in Germany in the days after Munich, as this writer was, can forget the rapture of the German people. They were relieved that war had been averted. They were elated and swollen with pride at Hitler's bloodless victory, not only over Czechoslovakia, but over Great Britain and France. Within the short space of 6 months, they reminded you, Hitler had conquered Austria and the Sudetenland, adding 10 million inhabitants to the Third Reich and a vast strategic territory which opened the way for German domination of southeastern Europe, and without the loss of a single German life. With the instinct of a genius rare in German history, he had divined not only the weaknesses of the smaller states in Central Europe, but those of the two principal Western democracies, Britain and France, and forced them to bend to his will. He had invented and used with staggering success a new strategy and technique of political warfare, which made actual war unnecessary. In scarcely 4.5 years, this man of lowly origins had catapulted a disarmed, chaotic, nearly bankrupt Germany, the weakest of the big powers in Europe, to a position where she was regarded as the mightiest nation of the Old World, before which all the others, Britain even and France, trembled. At no step in this dizzy ascent had the victorious powers of Versailles dared to try to stop her, even when they had the power to do so. Indeed, at Munich, which registered the greatest conquest of all, Britain and France had gone out of their way to support her. And what must have amazed Hitler most of all, it certainly astounded General Beck, Hassel, and others in their small circle of opposition, was that none of the men who dominated the governments of Britain and France, little worms, as the Führer contemptuously spoke of them in private after Munich, realized the consequences of their inability to react with any force to one after the other of the Nazi leaders' aggressive moves. Winston Churchill in England alone seemed to understand. No one stated the consequences of Munich more succinctly than he in his speech to the Commons of October 5th. "We have sustained a total and unmitigated defeat. We are in the midst of a disaster of the first magnitude. The road down the Danube, the road to the Black Sea, has been opened. All the countries of Mitteleuropa and the Danube Valley, one after another, will be drawn in the vast system of Nazi politics radiating from Berlin. And do not suppose that this is the end. It is only the beginning." But Churchill was not in the government, and his words went unheeded. Was the Franco-British surrender at Munich necessary? Was Adolf Hitler not bluffing? The answer, paradoxically, to both questions, we know now, is no. All the generals close to Hitler who survived the war agree that had it not been for Munich, Hitler would have attacked Czechoslovakia on October 1, 1938. and they presume that whatever momentary hesitations there might have been in London, Paris, and Moscow, in the end, Britain, France, and Russia would have been drawn into the war. And, what is most important to this history at this point, the German generals agree unanimously that Germany would have lost the war, and in short order. The argument of the supporters of Chamberlain and Daladier, and they were in the great majority at the time, that Munich saved the West not only from war but from defeat in war and, incidentally, preserved London and Paris from being wiped out by the Luftwaffe's murderous bombing, has been impressively refuted, so far as concern the last 2 points, by those in a position to know best, the German generals, and especially those generals who were closest to Hitler and who supported him from beginning to end the most fanatically. The leading light among the latter was General Keitel, chief of OKW, toady to Hitler and constantly at his side. When asked on the stand at the Nuremberg trial what the reaction of the German generals was to Munich, he replied, "We were extraordinarily happy that it had not come to a military operation, because we had always been of the opinion that our means of attack against the frontier fortifications of Czechoslovakia were insufficient. From a purely military point of view, we lacked the means for an attack which involved the piercing of the frontier fortifications." It has always been assumed by Allied military experts that the German army would have romped through Czechoslovakia. But to the testimony of Keitel that this would not have been the case must be added that of Field Marshal von Manstein, who became one of the most brilliant of the German field commanders. When he, in his turn, testified at Nuremberg, unlike Keitel and Jodl, he was not on trial for his life, on the German position at the time of Munich, he explained, "If a war had broken out, neither our western border nor our Polish frontier could really have been effectively defended by us. And there is no doubt whatsoever that had Czechoslovakia defended herself, we would have been held up by her fortifications, for we did not have the means to break through." Even Hitler became at least partly convinced of this after he had inspected the Czech fortress line. He later told Dr. Karl Burkhardt, League of Nations High Commissioner of Danzig, "When, after Munich, we were in a position to examine Czechoslovak military strength from within, what we saw of it greatly disturbed us. We had run a serious danger. The plan prepared by the Czech generals was formidable. I now understand why my generals urged restraint." Pertinax, The Gravediggers of France, page 5. Jodl, the brains of OKW, put it this way when he took the stand in his own defense at Nuremberg. "It was out of the question. With 5 fighting divisions and 7 reserve divisions in the western fortifications, which were nothing but a large construction site, to hold out against 100 French divisions, that was militarily impossible." If, as these German generals concede, Hitler's army lacked the means of penetrating the Czech fortifications, and Germany, in the face of France's overwhelming strength in the west, was in a militarily impossible situation, and further, since, as we have seen, there was such grave dissension among the generals that the chief of the Army General Staff was prepared to overthrow the Führer in order to avert a hopeless war, why, then, did not the French and British General Staffs know this? Or did they? And if they did, how could the heads of government of Britain and France be forced at Munich into sacrificing so much of their nation's vital interests? In seeking answers to such questions, we confront one of the mysteries of the Munich time which has not yet been cleared up. Even Churchill, concerned as he is with military affairs, scarcely touches on it in his massive memoirs. It is inconceivable that the British and French general staffs and the two governments did not know of the opposition of the German army general staff to a European war. For, as already noted here, the conspirators in Berlin warned the British of this through at least 4 channels in August and September. And, as we know, the matter came to the attention of Chamberlain himself. By early September, Paris and London must have learned of the resignation of General Beck and of the obvious consequences to the German army of the rebellion of its most eminent and gifted leader. It was generally conceded in Berlin at this time that British and French military intelligence was fairly good. It is extremely difficult to believe that the military chiefs in London and Paris did not know of the obvious weaknesses of the German army and air force and of their inability to fight a 2-front war. What doubts could the chief of staff of the French army, General Gamelin, have, despite his inbred caution, which was monumental, that with nearly 100 divisions he could overwhelm the 5 regular and 7 reserve German divisions in the west and sweep easily and swiftly deep into Germany. On the whole, as he later recounted, Gamelin had few doubts. On September 12th, the day on which Hitler was thundering his threats against Czechoslovakia at the closing session of the Nuremberg rally, the French Generalissimo had assured Premier Daladier that if war came, the democratic nations would dictate the peace. He says he backed it up with a letter expressing the reasons for his optimism. On September 26th, at the height of the Czech crisis following the Godesberg meeting, Gamelin, who had accompanied the French government leaders to London, repeated his assurances to Chamberlain and tried to substantiate them with an analysis of the military situation calculated to buck up not only the British Prime Minister, but his own wavering premier. In this attempt, apparently, he failed. Finally, just before Daladier flew to Munich, Gamelin outlined to him the limits of territorial concessions in the Sudetenland which could be made without endangering French security. The main Czech fortifications, as well as the rail trunk lines, certain strategic branch lines, and the principal defense industries, must not be given to Germany. Above all, he added, the Germans must not be permitted to cut off the Moravian Gap. Good advice, if Czechoslovakia was to be of any use to France in a war with Germany, but, as we have seen, Daladier was not the man to act on it. A good deal was said at the time of Munich that one reason for Chamberlain's surrender was his fear that London would be obliterated by German bombing. And there is no doubt that the French were jittery at the awful prospect of their beautiful capital being destroyed from the air. But from what is now known of the Luftwaffe's strength at this moment, the Londoners and the Parisians, as well as the Prime Minister and the Premier, were unduly alarmed. The German Air Force, like the Army, was concentrated against Czechoslovakia, and therefore, like the Army, was incapable of serious action in the West. Even if a few German bombers could have been spared to attack London and Paris, it is highly doubtful that they would have reached their targets. Weak as the British and French fighter defenses were, the Germans could not have given their bombers fighter protection if they had had the planes. Their fighter bases were too far away. It has also been argued, most positively by Ambassadors François Poncet and Henderson, that Munich gave the two Western democracies nearly a year to catch up with the Germans in rearmament. The facts belie such an argument. As Churchill, backed up by every serious Allied military historian, has written, the year's breathing space, said to be gained by Munich, left Britain and France in a much worse position compared to Hitler's Germany than they had been at the Munich crisis. As we shall see, all the German military calculations a year later bear this out, and subsequent events, of course, remove any doubts whatsoever. In retrospect, and with the knowledge we now have from the secret German documents and from the post-war testimony of the Germans themselves, the following summing up, which was impossible to make in the days of Munich, may be given. Germany was in no position to go to war on October 1, 1938, against Czechoslovakia and France and Britain, not to mention Russia. Had she done so, she would have been quickly and easily defeated, and that would have been the end of Hitler and the Third Reich. If a European war had been averted at the last moment by the intercession of the German army, Hitler might have been overthrown by Halder and Witzleben and their confederates, carrying out their plan to arrest him as soon as he had given the final order for the attack on Czechoslovakia. By publicly boasting that he would march into the Sudetenland by October 1st in any case, Hitler had put himself far out on a limb. He was in the untenable position which General Beck had foreseen. Had he, after all his categorical threats and declarations, tried to crawl back from the limb on his own, he scarcely could have survived for long, dictatorships being what they are, and his dictatorship in particular being what it was. It would have been extremely difficult, if not impossible, for him to have backed down. And had he tried to do so, his loss of prestige in Europe among his own people and, above all with his generals, would most likely have proved fatal. Chamberlain's stubborn, fanatical insistence on giving Hitler what he wanted, his trips to Berchtesgaden and Godesberg, and finally the fateful journey to Munich, rescued Hitler from his limb and strengthened his position in Europe, in Germany, in the army, beyond anything that could have been imagined a few weeks before. It also added immeasurably to the power of the Third Reich vis-à-vis the Western democracies and the Soviet Union. For France, Munich was a disaster, and it is beyond understanding that this was not fully realized in Paris. Her military position in Europe was destroyed, because her army, when the Reich was fully mobilized, could never be much more than half the size of that of Germany, which had nearly twice her population, and because her ability to produce arms was also less, France had laboriously built up her alliances with the smaller powers in the east on the other flank of Germany, and of Italy, Czechoslovakia, Poland, Yugoslavia, and Romania, which together had the military potential of a big power. The loss now of 35 well-trained, well-armed Czech divisions, deployed behind their strong mountain fortifications and holding down an even larger German force, was a crippling one to the French army. But that was not all. After Munich, how could France's remaining allies in Eastern Europe have any confidence in her written word? What value now were alliances with France? The answer in Warsaw, Bucharest, and Belgrade was, not much. And there was a scramble in these capitals to make the best deal possible, while there was still time, with the Nazi conqueror. And, if not a scramble, there was a stir in Moscow. Though the Soviet Union was militarily allied to both Czechoslovakia and France, the French government had gone along with Germany and Britain without protest in excluding Russia from Munich. It was a snub which Stalin did not forget, and which was to cost the two Western democracies dearly in the months to come. On October 3rd, 4 days after Munich, the counselor of the German embassy in Moscow, Werner von Tippelskirch, reported to Berlin on the consequences of Munich for Soviet policy. He thought Stalin would draw conclusions. He was certain the Soviet Union would reconsider her foreign policy, become less friendly to her ally France, and more positive toward Germany. As a matter of fact, the German diplomat thought that the present circumstances offer favorable opportunities for a new and wider German economic agreement with the Soviet Union. This is the first mention in the secret German archives of a change in the wind that now began to stir, however faintly, over Berlin and Moscow, and which within a year would have momentous consequences. Despite his staggering victory and the humiliation he administered not only to Czechoslovakia but to the Western democracies, Hitler was disappointed with the results of Munich. "That fellow Chamberlain," Schacht heard him exclaim to his SS entourage on his return to Berlin, "has spoiled my entry into Prague." That was what he really had wanted all along, as he had constantly confided to his generals since his lecture to them on November 5th of the previous year. The conquest of Austria and Czechoslovakia, he had explained then, was to be but the preliminary for a major drive for Lebensraum in the east and a military settlement with France in the west. As he had told the Hungarian Prime Minister on September 20th, the best thing was to destroy Czechoslovakia. This, he had said, would provide the only satisfactory solution. He was only afraid of the danger that the Czechs might submit to all of his demands. Now Mr. Chamberlain, grasping his much-publicized umbrella, had come to Munich and forced the Czechs to submit to all his demands, and thereby had deprived him of his military conquest. Such, it is evident from the record, were Hitler's tortuous thoughts after Munich. "It was clear to me from the first moment," he later confided to his generals, "that I could not be satisfied with the Sudeten German territory. That was only a partial solution." A few days after Munich, the German dictator set in motion plans to achieve a total solution.